Our reading this morning comes from the poet Sharon Olds. It's entitled, "After 37 Years, My Mother Apologizes for My Childhood." When you tilted toward me, arms out like someone trying to walk through a fire, when you swayed toward me, crying out you were sorry for what you had done to me, your eyes filling with terrible liquid like balls of mercury from a broken thermometer skidding on the floor, when you quietly screamed, "Where else could I turn? Who else did I have?" The chopped crookery of your hands swinging toward me, the water crackling from your eyes like moisture from stones under heavy pressure. I could not see what I would do with the rest of my life. The sky seemed to be splintering, like a window someone is bursting into or out of. Your tiny face glittered as if with shattered crystal, with true regret, the regret of your body. I could not see what my days would be with your sorry, with you wishing you had not done it. The sky falling around me, its shards glistening in my eyes, your old, soft body fallen against me in horror. I took you in my arms. I said, "It's all right. Don't cry. It's all right." The air filled with flying glass. I hardly knew what I said or who I would be now that I had forgiven you.
Last Sunday, I told you, you might remember, about my friend's lake cabin and the ledge that I was too afraid to jump off. Well, I wasn't always so cautious as a child. It turns out actually quite the opposite in a lot of cases. For example, I was in about, I think it was fifth grade, and I was at summer camp. And I was late for the campfire circle that was going to start and pretty soon. I had been getting something in my cabin when they'd called everyone to start the long trek down the hill. My cabin was at the top of the hill, and there was a like zigzagging line that had switchbacks in order to get down to the bottom of the hill where the campfire was. And by the time I realized that they had been calling everyone to come to go down for the campfire, they were already about halfway down. I was worried because I love the beginning of the campfire. It meant all of the campfire songs with all the hand gestures and everything, my favorite part. And so I wondered how I would be able to get down there when I remembered that often when I was down there, there was a bunch of older kids that had found a shortcut between the, they would like cut off the switchbacks and just went straight down the steep incline. And so these older kids, they would arrive like laughing and joyous and running right smack into like almost right where we all were gathering. So I thought, perfect. Okay. I can grab that switchback or that cutoff. So I went down the regular part of the trail and I, found my way to the little cutoff. When I decided to, you know, run down it because I was really late. I could see them already starting. So I jumped on and I started running. And of course I am, I was smaller than some of the other, those older kids. And thus my legs were a little shorter and got caught running. You know, it was a steep incline and I was running really fast. So as you can already imagine, instead of arriving laughing at the campfire, instead I arrived flat on my belly, splayed out. Yeah, it was horrible. And I had blood covered from my ankles all the way up to my knees. instead of enjoying the campfire songs, I got to travel slowly back up the regular trail, back and forth, all the way to the nurse's station where she patched me up. I still have scars, actually. I have like one right here, over 3 decades later. You know, sometimes when we talk about plunging into the unknown or making that brave and bold leap, saying yes to the transformative moment for which we can never fully prepare, we forget to talk about what happens after the leap. We forget to talk about the broken skin or the broken hearts, the broken vows or the broken relationships, that proverbial mourning after. Not every fear that kept us cautious, it turns out, not every fear is unfounded. Even if the intention is good and the leap righteous, there is still always the possibility of something, if not everything, going terribly, horribly wrong. And there can always be that significant and unforeseen collateral damage. Now, in a traditional religious setting, we would call this the reality of sin, which is a word and concept that comes for many with all sorts of feelings of guilt or shame left over either from old other religious traditions or maybe even just from cultural influence that we've taken on, where fundamentalists have been kind of overly fixated on enforcing their views of an ethical sexuality and calling that sin. But all this personal and societal baggage obscures the original intent of the word, which, especially from a Jewish perspective, was mostly just about the idea of missing the mark. Now, depending on the circumstances, missing the mark can either be a really big deal or not that big of a deal. Like, you know, are you playing darts and just sort of barely missing the dartboard and hitting the wall? That's missing the mark. Or are you performing heart surgery and barely missing the mark that has been set for you? Both of these are missing the mark, but depending on the circumstances, the impact is significantly different. Coming to terms with the circumstances that surrounding impact of our mark missing, facing it fully and taking responsibility both for that reality and the ongoing impact, is the work of Teshuvah, which is the time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that Victoria Safer described in the reading that Ali and I offered. It is that time between Rosh Hashanah, the new year. Rosh Hashanah is like an opening, an invitation. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is the healing. Teshuvah is the bridge between. Now, these two holy days represent the bulk of what I find we usually talk about when it comes to forgiveness and the restoration of relationships. So that when someone asks to be forgiven, the invitation, then we offer forgiveness, atonement. It is our practice and our promise. There is nothing that you could do that would place you beyond the reach of courageous and transforming love. Though you have broken your vows 1,000 times, come, yet again come. The invitation, the healing. On the other hand, the middle journey of Teshuvah between these two things, which has its roots, you can hear it in the word shuv, that is to turn. This middle journey of Teshuvah is often taken for granted, as if it is automatic and obvious, as if too much attention in that intervening work of repair might indicate that we had a lack of compassion or mercy, as if all apologies are equal, as if a small hole in the wall is the same thing as a small hole in the heart. It was not quite a year ago, towards the end of last October, when the news broke of comedian Louis C.K. and his pattern of appalling behavior with women. It was that time, you remember, about a year ago, when it felt like every day there was one, maybe sometimes two in the same day, powerful, influential men who we admire or respect, the good guys that we found out that had been for years engaging in inappropriate, manipulative, misogynist, and or downright abusive behavior. Louis C.K., his stuff probably fit into all of these. As the stories came out, he issued an apology, which at the time I thought of as pretty remarkable, primarily because he started by flat out saying, these stories are true. I know it's a low bar, but after a bunch of men before that, their first response had been to deny and attempt to discredit and demean the women who were coming forward. It felt revolutionary. They just didn't go there. He just said, flat out, these stories are true. And further, he affirmed their experience and began to take responsibility. This is a quote from his apology. I wielded my power irresponsibly. I took advantage of the fact that I was widely admired in my and their community, which disabled them from sharing their story and brought hardship to them when they tried, because people who look up to me didn't want to hear it. He went on to say, there is nothing about this that I forgive myself for, and I have to reconcile it with who I am, which is nothing compared to the task that I can hardly wrap my head around the scope of hurt I brought on them. I've spent my long and lucky career talking and saying anything I want. I will now step back and take a long time to listen. And then he did. He stepped back. He stepped away from multiple TV shows that he was working on at the time. Stepped away from a movie and from comedy more generally, or rather mostly these things kind of stepped away from him. As reported by NPR, he was dropped by his management company. FX, HBO, and Netflix all severed ties with him, and he pretty much disappeared. That is, until about 3 weeks ago, when he showed up for a stand-up spot in a New York City club, indicating that perhaps 10 months was a long enough time to listen. The reaction, as you can imagine, was pretty mixed, with some focus on the price that he had already paid, and others wondering if he had yet really listened well enough or grappled fully with his actions. After all, his apology statement that I read from, it never actually said the words, "I'm sorry." And now here he was, just kind of slipping back into the comedy stage with no mention, no acknowledgement, no words uttered about the journey he'd been on, I'm sorry or otherwise. And really no evidence on that stage, at least, that anything had changed, including, most importantly, his heart. This is where the turning of teshuvah begins. That is a turning into your heart, a turning to ourselves, a turning to what we have done. It begins with something we call recognition. Before we can even think about the return, the restoring, we must recognize in ourselves, not just who we wish we were, but who we actually are. Not just our intentions, but also our impact. To see our complex motivations, those places that we keep hidden from ourselves and others, that is our ego, our grief, our anger, our fear, all these things often compounded over the years, and all of these which brought us to miss the mark, to keep missing the mark. And we recognize the pain that as a result we are responsible for, the brokenness, to know that this too is a part of our story, to set this alongside the other reality, which is our wholeness. Our culture today doesn't do a lot to help us in this work of recognizing our own wrongdoing. Instead, it teaches us to shift the blame, save face, and cultivate practices of defensiveness and passive voice acknowledgments. As in, you might not, I missed the mark. You might instead hear, the mark was missed. Just turn on to any congressional hearing these days. You'll find it not, I missed the mark, but the mark was missed. Instead of shifting blame, this practice of teshuvah invites us to acknowledge our responsibility, especially by hearing directly from those we impacted, individuals or communities, and attempting to see things from their perspective to enter their world just even a little. And then to accept that these costs, these injuries they experienced were in fact the result of our action. Regardless of our intent, regardless of the other factors that may have been at play, our job is to simply recognize and accept. Which is why the next piece of teshuvah is often remorse. The inner conflict that comes with real acceptance can be overwhelming. Remorse is one step further than simple regret, which you can feel pretty readily for all sorts of things that you simply wish were differently. Like, I regret that. But remorse connects us in a deeper way to the understanding of the ways that our actions led to another's pain. And it contains there the seeds of real change. As Rabbi David Blumenthal describes, remorse encompasses our feelings of being lost or trapped, of anguish and perhaps even despair, as well as being alienated from our own deepest spiritual roots, of having abandoned our inner selves. Genuine remorse is often motivating because of its misery. We do not want to feel this kind of alienation from ourselves or others, and in the same way ever again. And so we resolve to refrain from repeating the same action again in the future, which is the third piece of teshuvah, refrain. That is, to simply choose not to pick back up this same path that led us here, to instead commit to the turning, the change, for real. In my reading about this practice, what I learned is that all the other pieces, you could let go of every other piece, but this one, this choice, this commitment to not repeat, to refrain, this is the one that is most critical, that most allows for that move from the invitation to the actual healing. Now, because changing habits is never easy or readily accomplished in a 10-day period marked by an ancient tradition, but rather require a daily commitment over the long haul, this is probably a good moment to remind us that this whole path is best traveled with help. To find what the Jewish tradition might call a minion, which is not like the little yellow creatures that your children and grandchildren want to dress up for Halloween. It's minion, M-I-N-Y-A-N, which is a collection of other imperfect people who have promised to pray and gather and struggle and grow with you. We'd call this the covenanted congregation. People who will promise to practice together new habits of the heart. Now, refraining from repeating the same action fits nicely along the other major move of teshuvah, which attempts to heal the actual damage that was done, as in restitution. You know, repay the money, rebuild the reputation, tell the truth. It is not always possible, of course, to make things exactly as they were before the break. But as one Jewish teaching acknowledges, the work of repair has its own intrinsic purposes. Regardless of whether or not the repair can ever actually be accomplished, it is the effort and the resulting change of heart that matters. Which brings us back to Louis C.K. and the words he said and the ones he did not in his attempt to return. Because the last piece of teshuvah is revelation, as in your own, as in the out loud acknowledgement of all the other pieces, out loud recognition, out loud remorse, out loud resolving to refrain, out loud attempt at restitution. Everything that I've read and learned about this process, this journey, points to the necessity of the verbal acknowledgement, which takes something that has been hidden and internal and subconscious to something that is externalized and therefore accountable. As the medieval Jewish philosopher and scholar Maimonides wrote, we need to make this confession with our lips moving. To say these things out loud that we have resolved in our heart. And by the way, nothing that I read indicates that an email or a text is sufficient. Even if you like move your mouth while you type. Depending on the situation of those circumstances of the mark being missed, the out loud might be offered to one or to many, to God or the universe, with candles and ritual or over a table at a coffee shop with your heart pounding and your palms sweating. However it comes, it must acknowledge and integrate all parts of teshuva. Otherwise, it remains provisional, partial, and probably inadequate for real return and restoration. In this age of shifting blame and saving face, where apologies are considered amazing just for acknowledging that a thing that happened, happened, where it can feel like so much work to go back up the hill and get stitched up, I've been wondering lately what it would mean to take up this practice, this intervening time in every part of our lives, in our families, in our friendships, in our church, in our city, in our country, to imagine that we are capable, that we are worthy of moments just like the one in the poem that Sean read, moments where someone that we love who has also hurt us, maybe for a long, long time, to imagine that they are capable and we are worthy of them coming to us with real recognition and real remorse, with a commitment to refrain and a plan for restitution, to say, I am so sorry. And there in a flash, the sky splinters and everything changes. So much so, we wonder, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? We know there are many reasons to forgive. Even if this work never happens, we have to make do with inadequate apologies all the time. And so we are always free, as Lily Tomlin defines forgiveness, to stop wishing for a different or better past. We are always free. And it can be so liberating to just let go. But imagine if we traveled this path more intentionally, more fully, this path of turning and turning and turning again. And then from this place, we offer forgiveness to say, it's all right. And to mean it. Because the apology is so real that the forgiveness is too. And so is the healing and the wholeness and the being made new. Forgiveness offered from this place is not just liberating, it is transforming. And it is a practice that we should ask, we can and should ask of one another and of ourselves. Not because we are not compassionate or merciful, but because we believe so fully in our equal inherent worth and in our interdependence that we are willing to take seriously our part in the web and take seriously then the necessary work for repair, the work that comes before atonement, which is better pronounced at one-ment. The work to first acknowledge all the cracks across all our lives that we ourselves have made, and then together let the light shine through. May it be so, and amen.